Well, good evening. I thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. It's been a long time. Been so long that the men have become old men, that the youth have become men, and that the boys and girls have become youth, and the babies have become boys and girls. So there's a lot of faces that just I recognize, but they look a good bit different, and you can feel the same way. I appreciated what David Showalter, a new face here, mentioned about publishers and purpose. So I am teaching school again part-time. And so when I walk into the school building or into my classroom, I know what is expected. I know what I'm supposed to do, okay? No question. Matter of fact, everybody else knows what I'm supposed to do. And when I'm around, they know what they're supposed to do. I'm supposed to pay attention. And I'm supposed to have something for them to pay attention about. I also work at a wood shop. And when I walk into the wood shop, I know what I'm there for. Okay? I know what my purpose is. And I'm good of enough guy that when I go to these places, I do what I'm supposed to do. Okay. not tooting any horns or anything, but yeah, I know what I'm supposed to do, and I do it. I know what's expected, and the people around me know what to expect of me. And I don't know if there's any mechanics here, but when a mechanic walks into his mechanic shop, he knows what he's supposed to do. You still do that? Yeah, work on cars. Something important about knowing your purpose. You can walk around the streets and you can actually see people. It's kind of obvious that they do not know what their purpose is. It just becomes a very obvious thing. And if you watch them very long, it's actually kind of frustrating for people to understand purpose. They don't know it, but they are frustrated as well. Okay. They act like it sometimes. So tonight, I'm a follower of Jesus. You're a follower of Jesus. And when we wake up in the morning, do we have the same sense of direction that we have when we walk into our job? Whatever that is, do we have that same sense of purpose that guides us and we are confident about what we are doing? It's kind of what I want to talk about tonight.
This is a big one.
So I kind of like letters. I don't know if it's because we live in a text world, but everything has letters. You're supposed to know what they mean. So I'll let you figure that out for a while. When we have purpose, it gives us not only a sense of direction, but if we adopt that purpose, it gives us drive, it gives us motivation, it gives us a power that moves us. And we can kind of lose the fire of that purpose, and our life becomes kind of dull. But I want to inspire us tonight with the purpose of following Jesus. Hopefully you all know what it is, but hopefully I'm not telling you anything new except what the letters for it are, that You get up in the morning and you walk into your bedroom, you walk into your kitchen, you walk outside, you get in your car, so go somewhere, and you know what you're doing. And you can and do it confidently. So what is the single most important command for a follower of Jesus? What is the one single most important command for following Jesus? And I hope that it kind of throws some light bulbs on. There was a lawyer, a smart man. I mean, he knew stuff. Like he knew how to sort things out. He knew what was right, what was wrong. And he came to Jesus and he said, "So what? What is the most important commandment?" And I would like us to say that, quote that together. It might not all come together, but you say what part you remember. The order might be different, but I think we'll all get the same thing out. So he told him, now I can't even start it. Someone help me out. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and with all thy and neighbor as thyself. No, you missed a phrase in there. I did too. Yeah, the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So why? I've wondered this. Maybe you know. Why did Jesus give him two of them? He wanted the one most important one. And Jesus threw two of them at him. So, and I used to think, well, the one was more important than the other. And so he put that one first and gave the next one second. But I've changed my mind. Jesus couldn't give the one without the other. And that's how I now read that little line in there. It says, the second is like unto it. They're essentially the same thing. And if you read the book of James or the book of 1 John, you find out that's true. As a matter of fact, there are a few places when it finally gives the one command that we should all have, that's the only one it gives. Love your neighbor as yourself. James says that, and 1 John explains it. Love your neighbor as yourself. And I want to, again, impress on you how important that is tonight. And I hope when you wake up in the morning, you think, love one another. That's what those stand for, if you haven't figured it out yet. What does loving your brother or loving one another look like? So if that's what we are supposed to do, I should be able to look at that, think that, and it should have the same kind of direction as when I walk into a classroom, or when I walk into the wood shop, or when I walk into a mechanic shop, or when I walk into my store. You know what comes next. You know what to do. And if you get it good, you can do it like clockwork. You get to the end of the day and say, that went pretty good. Or sometimes you get to the end of the day and say, wow, wish I could start that one over again. We have this commandment, love one another. And can we get up in the morning, walk into our day, and have the same kind of confidence? What does that look like? I just want to, again, connect these two, loving God and loving your neighbor. I'll give you the verse in 1 John 4:20. It says, if a man says, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. He's not just a little white liar. He's a liar, okay? You cannot say you love God and hate your brother. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen? So love your brother. If you want to love God, you love your brother. I want to start with, Jesus gave us two standards for this thing. He says, love your neighbor as yourself. So how do we measure this, loving our neighbor? We measure it by how well we love ourselves. Okay, that's the one standard he gives. He also told his disciples, I'm giving you a new commandment, a very similar one. And he says, as I have loved you, love one another. So that's another standard. And he doesn't say one's better than the other. Sometimes I think we can relate to one a little better than the other. There might be times it's easier for me to figure out going by one than the other. But I want to talk about those two standards so that we get a picture of what this loving one another can look like. And I want to start with some core needs, some core longings that I think every human being has. I know I have them, and I really think you all have them. And if you sit down and watch people, you can sometimes watch them happen. Okay, it might have to be a little bit of a psychologist, but it just happens. People live out of some basic longings, basic needs. I'm just going to list three of them. You could probably list more, but some that I think are pretty basic. One is preservation. Okay, we will go to great ends to preserve ourselves. Okay, if everything is gone, we will try to find a way to make it, to hang on, to keep living. Another one is to belong, to be accepted. You just watch people in the early teen years, do some interesting things to try to find acceptance, to belong. And another one is purpose. Everybody wants some kind of purpose in their life, and they'll make them up. Sometimes they'll make them up to have some kind of purpose. It might be just to annoy somebody, but you can tell that's their purpose. They work hard at it. Well, how can I translate this to loving my neighbor? Well, let's take the first one. So if I have this desire to preserve myself, then somehow I need to translate that to my relationship to my neighbor. And just to define neighbor, I'll just remind you of the story of the Good Samaritan. We're all familiar with that. It's the people that are around you are your neighbors. Okay, so how do I take this desire to be preserved, to live? How can I translate that to my neighbor? Well, I'll give you two things. Then again, we could be more, but I'll just give you two to give you a picture. One is intervening for someone when there's danger. I'll give you one example of how not to do that. Okay. I think I was 14 or 15. We lived in south of Chambersburg, Guilford Township. And we went to Anchor Christian School up in Shippensburg. And we would drive this little car we had, an old Renault. I haven't seen one for years. I think I know why. So we had this little thing, and my sister would drive us to school. I wasn't driving age yet, and then we would come home. It was winter time. We had been to school, and we were going home. It was snowy. I don't know if we had got out early, but it was snowy. It was slippery. And we come through Chambersburg to get onto Wayne Avenue, where it all comes together there, and then it goes up over the railroad tracks. Okay, well, it's snowy, it's icy, and we're at the bottom, and we see this tanker truck, I don't know if the milk truck or something, up at the top. He was kind of easing himself over the top, and just as we got to the bottom, he must have eased himself too far, and he couldn't stop easing. He just kind of eased down, coming right at our dear Renault. Well, brave me, I open my door and I bail. Like, I run. My sister's there trying to find reverse and all that kind of stuff, and I am out of here. Like, I'm not tangling with a tanker. Well, and I just left my sister set. That is not the way to intervene in danger. I will let you decide what I should have done, but I didn't. So I'm just giving you an example of how not to do this. Like the Anthony's story of Edward Spencer. Edward, right? Yeah. Now there's a man that loved his neighbor. He put himself at risk to save people's lives. And it cost him something. But I would like for someone to do that for me. I like to preserve myself, and if I can't do it, if there's someone that can help me, I would enjoy that. I would really be thankful. Apparently they weren't. Well, they didn't say it. But always turn this thing around. I like to be preserved. There's somebody out there. If I see somebody that is in danger, that needs some help, can I put myself out to help preserve their life? Pretty simple. And there's small ways we can do that. You know, maybe I should have said, get that thing in neutral and I'll get in front of the car and I'll try to push it backwards. They're not very big. Once I started driving, I could push it around. Like if it didn't want to start, I could push it and jump in, pop the clutch and go with it. So I probably could have pushed it. We might have pushed it out of the way. The truck wasn't coming down. It was just kind of, there's probably time to push it clear back in the middle of town. I don't know. But that was not my first thought. Bad deal right there. That was not loving my neighbor. I think another one is giving correction. This one's a little harder. And sometimes a person is not very accepting of it immediately. But as a parent, we soon learn the importance of loving our child by giving them correction. So we had some children that would lie. Okay, some of them got pretty good at it. I mean, they keep a straight face, look you in the eye, and just tell you a flat lie. Well, you don't want to let that go. I mean, for two reasons. One is you don't know whether to believe them or not. But a bigger reason is you don't want them going into life like that. That's not a good way to enter life. They need to learn that if they want to be trustworthy people, they want people to accept them, people to be able to work with people, they're going to have to be honest. And so you give them correction. And I think we need to do that for the people around us in a kind and loving way, but they need to know what is the right thing. And if you see them doing something that is not correct, that's dangerous, it's a type of intervention. It's before something gets into a really bad situation. Teaching school, so they're doing their math problems and they're getting them wrong. Students hate red pens, but that's how they learn, okay? You put marks on their paper and say, you did that wrong. And they're like kicking themselves and no, quit that. That's not gonna get you anywhere. Figure out what happened and learn to do it right. And you will enjoy math. They don't believe it, but they will after a while. When things work out, you start to enjoy them. But you know you don't want them to enter life not knowing how to work with numbers. I mean, banks, if they're going to deal with a bank, they're going to have to, they should know what's happening. I mean, some people don't, and it's not a good story. But correct when you see people doing wrong so that when they face life, they know the proper way to do it. What about belonging? I feel like I've learned a lot about this one, probably from myself, but also relating to not only my children, but a lot of teenagers in school. Learn to show acceptance and value by being willing to invest your time, your skills to benefit the other person. I've done some weird things to try to get acceptance and notice an investment by others. But don't make it so difficult for them, especially if it's someone you're around a lot. That person should feel your acceptance and your willingness to invest in them as a person. There is nothing, I don't think there is anything that shows acceptance like investment in your children, in each other, in other people. Well, so what are some practical ways to do that? I feel like, at least for me, this might not be for everybody, but I think one of the ways that works best for me is be willing to listen to somebody. Be willing to hear them out, even if it is the most boring thing, or maybe sometimes even something you don't want to hear. But if you're willing to hear what they have to say, you've told them that they are valuable enough to do to you to take your time to listen to. And also, whenever opportunity affords, be willing to share yourself with them. Be willing to talk back to them with some things in your own experience that might match something they've told you. That's a bit of investment. Quite a few of you have been to the room. There are some names there that probably will always be in people's minds that have been there for any length of time. One of them is Daryl Burkholder. Firing some bells. So there's been times I've sat and listened to Daryl. And if any of you have ever done that, you know it's easy to think you could be doing something a little more worthwhile. Okay? That just won't be hard to imagine. But one thing I noticed when I was willing to take time to listen to him and to hear him out and respond, not always maybe what he wanted, but give him some kind of a genuine response to what he said, there was a certain respect that started to grow there. I could, by the time, well, he was killed, but I could pretty much tell him anything I felt like I needed to, and he would listen. Maybe he did that to everybody, but I feel like it was because I felt something begin to grow of respect. And I didn't realize how much influence what I told him had on him until one day Patrick told me he took him to Harrisburg and there was this thunderstorm and he was really getting nervous about this thunderstorm. And I'm like listening to him talk about it, lightning and carrying on, and Patrick was like, "What? What's your problem?" And so I forget exactly how it came together, but it had been about a week before that, he was telling me about playing the lottery. And, you know, how he plays the lottery. And I'm like, "God, you really don't want to do that. It's a waste of money." "Yeah, yeah, I put $20 in, and I won $10. And he was all excited. I said, "Well, yeah, if you give me $20, I'll give you $10. He's like, "Will you?" I said, "No, I can't do that to you." But I said, "You know what?" I said, "There's more chance of getting struck by lightning than winning the lottery." Okay. I can't believe he remembered that for a whole week. He was sure on going to Harrisburg he was going to hit by lightning. Yeah. Listen to people and be willing to share with them. And take time. If you see someone has a certain ability or you think they can develop some ability, take some time to invest in that ability. This one I don't think really amounted to much, but he had told me, Daryl, that he knows how to mop floors. So he's always asking people for $20. So I think one of the first or second times, I said, "Tell you what," we was in the room there, I said, "You mop this floor and I'll give you $10. Well, he mopped that floor, and he knew how to mop that floor. He actually did a good job. There was something that he could have actually done something with. I didn't have a bigger room to get him to mop some more, but that's something he could have made some use of, a skill that I think he had. I'm not sure where he learned it, or maybe it was just a $10. But one place where I really learned that this is important was at boys' camp. You bring boys from really bad situations, bring them into camp, give them some structure. That's one thing that helps. But it's amazing how learning a skill helps someone to develop a sense of value and purpose. There they learn how to make menus. They learn how to make itinerary for a trip. They learn how to cut their own firewood. They learn how to cook their food. It's amazing what giving somebody a skill will help to build in their own life. And that's a way to show them you are accepting them as a person. You're valuable. You're worth doing something. One thing I feel like I should mention along with this is you will have to be willing to be taken advantage of. You'll just have to accept that. We live in a world where people take advantage of that whenever they can, and that will happen. We had a neighbor. His name was Chad, and he was always asking for rides. He wanted a ride to town. Man didn't work a second of his life. And so I began to take him to town, you know, build a relationship. I listened to him. And finally, I learned enough to know that taking him to town was not helping him. Like, I'm not really being a friend. He wanted to go to Sheetz. Well, the Sheetz sells alcohol. So one time I was taking him to town, he wanted some money, and I forget if I was going to give him some or no. I said, "Well, I tell you what." I said, "I'll go in and buy stuff for you." "Oh, well, I can't ask you to do that." I'm like, "Okay." So I think that time I did give him some money, because he would sometimes get food too, take home to his wife. But I told him, I said, I won't do that again. And I said, I'm not taking you to Sheetz again. We will not go to Sheetz. Well, then he started asking going to McDonald's. I don't know if he thought I was a kindergartner or what, but McDonald's is right beside Sheetz. So I said, no, I won't take you to McDonald's. But I would still take him to town. It got to the point where I realized that I'm going to have to tell him exactly where I am with this. I say, well, I will take you to town if you're going to look for a job. And he actually did. He started looking for jobs. I take him to town. He actually got a job, and he lost it. And he wanted to ride to town. I said, go get your job back. Yeah, he can't. I said, why not? They won't take him back. Well, I learned the rest of the story. I think he had gotten mad and blown up at somebody, and they weren't going to have him back. But that was kind of a long journey where I did earn his respect. I could tell him what I needed to, but he still felt like he was entitled to the word entitlement to stuff, and he would still be willing to take advantage of me. I said, the only place I will take you is to a rehab. And, well, he didn't get me to take him. He went to one and then bailed out. But you will have to be willing to put up with some of those kinds of things where people will take advantage of it. People took advantage of Jesus, but I don't think we should try to figure out when all that's going to happen. I think if we see it happening, we need to respond appropriately. And the third one, purpose. Give or help this person, your neighbor. Find a reason for living. Sometimes there are people that have difficulty or for some reason do not find a purpose in life. Help them find that. Something to live for. You and I are always looking for something, and most people really are. The one boy there at the room, Damon, one of the twin boys, there are some that I'm not sure, I didn't learn to know well enough. It almost seemed like they didn't want a purpose. It was too much responsibility, and you may have people like that. But try to get somebody to move toward something in their life that will give them purpose, involvement in some kind of a project. One of my students at Anchor, he was graduating and he was kind of wondering what to do for the summer. So I said, well, why don't you go to Tidings of Peace? They usually want summer Bible school teachers. So he did that 1 year. And he told me, I think a year later, he said, that was the best thing I ever did. His name is Jesse Lehman. He lives out in Washington now. But he said it did something to his understanding of purpose in life, and changed the whole course of his life that he was forever grateful for. Not everyone does that. Sometimes you can even yourself make the opportunity for people to find purpose in life. Maybe it's the business you have. You see somebody that has a gift or an ability, something you can train them in, and you can invite them into that and invest in them that way. Make opportunities. One of the things I'm doing up at Perry, I have two young men that I feel like are very gifted speakers. They're young, but one thing I can do is I can give them an opportunity to use that in our congregation and help them develop that. And there are little ways you can do that with your children, with people that you're around. Help them. Put their lives into something that will give them direction. The other standard God gives us is, as Jesus loved us. And I just want to go through three things with that one. First of all, I think it was helpful for me to get a hold of, how did Jesus show me love? Did Jesus have the three same needs that I have and he was doing that? I don't know. I can't get a good enough picture of God to know how all that works. But we can know very clearly what Jesus did. That's explained enough in the Bible, and hopefully we've experienced it enough to know what Jesus did to show us his love, and he wants us to translate that to our brother. One is, he loved us before we were formed. You might want to let that one soak a little bit. How are you going to translate that one? God loved us. Jesus loved us before we were formed. One of my favorite passages on that is Psalm 139, where it says, I was formed in my mother's womb. Before I was formed, you had my whole life mapped out. All there. And you designed me with that in mind. I was designed and knit together with the purpose in mind that you had for me before I was formed. That's pretty awesome. How are we going to do that? Another one is, he loved us while we were yet sinners. While we were his enemies. A sinner is an enemy of God. Okay, I want you to make sure you get that. He didn't love us just because we were bad. We were actually his enemies. We were against him, and he loved us. You'll find that in Romans chapter 5. And another passage that's probably one of my favorites is Jesus' prayer with his disciples before he went into the garden. We call it the high priestly prayer. I call it his passionate prayer for you and I. At the end of that prayer, he says, his desire, his passion is for us who believe in him to be one with him and his Father. He wanted his disciples and those that believed on him because of his disciples, which is you and I, to be one with him as he is with his Father. I think that's pretty incredible that Jesus prayed that for Peter. For some, they were an interesting crew, but I'm not sure they're as interesting as you and I. We've just been pretty interesting too. God loves us. Jesus wants us to become one with him. That's his driving passion. That's what drove him to the cross. A powerful love. So how can we translate this loving somebody before they're formed into our loving our brother? I think it's important for us, to the best that we can, see or look for our brother's value outside of this present moment, this time right here and now, or this present situation. Jesus sees my value in a big picture that spans all of time and all of eternity. And our picture can't be as big as Christ. But I think God told us enough to give us a picture that you and I, all of us brothers and sisters, are part of something when we start following Jesus that includes everything from Adam and Eve to the end of time, and as a matter of fact, a lot of stuff that we don't know about. We're plugging into eternity. And when God created you and me, he created us with that in mind. He designed us to be a part of that big picture. And I need to look at my brother that way. He's part of something way bigger than this present moment. And can I love him with that kind of love? Be able and willing to believe that the present is not the future. What you see in your brother right now, and hopefully what he sees in me, is not going to be the same next week or next year. There's going to be some growth. There's going to be some development because God is working on us. And the faults you see now, the problems you see now, if he's following God, they're going to be part of his development. And can I love him for that? Can I love him for the fact that he's not going to be the same person now? And can I be a part of that? Can I join in with him with that? Consider how the current failures and losses can be steps toward recovery and redemption. When I was working with Chad, I still don't know what's going to happen. I don't even sure where he is now. But that was the one thing that I had to keep in mind if I was going to keep working with him, that there is a possibility that the investment that I put in to that man was, and the things that he was doing now, are not going to be forever. There is a possibility that if he connects with the love that God is showing him, hopefully through me and other people, if he can tap into that, he will become a different man. And there was a little bit of time I thought that was happening, and then I'm not sure what happened. But we should be able to do that with each other, and we're going to have to do that with people if we're going to be willing to work with people off the streets or in situations that are just bad. If we're going to think that the present is the future, then there's nothing to work for. What about this thing of Jesus loving us while we're his enemies? In some ways, I think this is probably one of the hardest ones, at least in my mind. The hardest hurdle, I feel like probably only a Christian can do this, at least do it consistently. But we need to be able to look past, or maybe even look through, someone's intent to ruin and destroy me, to the gift that that relationship could be if he will accept the love. Need to look through the intent he has to destroy me to the gift that that relationship will be if he will accept that love. That's the only way I can understand Jesus looking at us as enemies and saying, I'm going to love you. I'm going to die for you. Because he was looking at the gift that our relationship with him would be in eternity. And that was his hope. That was the joy that was set before him that helped him endure our actions against him, our actions that actually killed him. Can I do that to my brother? See through a person's faults and nastiness to the person God loves, to the person that God knitted together and longs to embrace. And I think some of that I learned through my experience at camp. Those boys could get really, really nasty. Some of the stories that I heard were worse than some of the things that I experienced. Some of them could get really aggressive after a chief who spent time and hours with them. And to be a chief that's able to work with that, you have to be able to look past what's happening right now or look through it and say, there's a boy that can become something. There's a boy that I can love and embrace if he will accept what I have to offer him. And am I willing to go through this to attempt that? And the last one, the desire to be one. Jesus wants us to be one with him. Do I have that desire for my brother? Or would I just prefer there be at least enough a distance that we don't quite have to be one. Just enough. I need a little bit of wiggle room. Or am I willing to embrace and be one with that person? Am I willing to pursue that? Jesus pursued that to his death. When Jesus says, lay down your life for your friend, I think that's the motivation. I'm willing to give my life for his. I would call that oneness. That's a oneness. Jesus prayed for that day as he faced the cross, prayed passionately. I can't read that prayer without getting goosebumps. Why? Why was he so passionate about that when he knew what was coming? When he knew what all these people, even these 12 around him, were going to do, he still passionately prayed that prayer for them. The goal is to keep a close relationship with my brother and keep making it closer and closer and closer. That's my primary goal. Even with the most difficult person, some days that might be your wife. Some days it might be your husband. A lot of times it's the people that are closest to you that are the most difficult to get along with, because there isn't a lot of wiggle room. You can't just leave. With your children, even when they grow up and decide they want to do something different, they want to take their own way, can I still have my primary goal to work, to do whatever I can to work toward oneness? It may not happen, but am I willing? Not everyone Jesus died for is going to be one with him, but he still died for them. And am I willing to pursue that as my goal with that child? Or with a difficult student, difficult customer, difficult neighbor, am I willing to work at it passionately so that the possibility is always there of oneness? There is no higher calling than to accept God's love in Christ, the love that he showed you and to me, and extend it to my neighbor, to my brother, or to my enemy. Ephesians talks about this high calling, and I think somehow it's this. That high calling is to allow God's love that has happened to me flow through me to the people that I'm around. The verse, right next verse after Jesus said, "A new commandment I give unto you, love as I have loved you," is by this, and I'm going to add by this one thing, all men will know that you are my disciple. I believe that the single most important commandment that Jesus gave to you and I as his followers is to love one another. I believe it's this one thing alone that I will have to give an account for when I stand before God. Have I loved my brother? Because if I haven't loved my brother, I haven't loved God. Matthew 25 is a very sobering chapter. It has three parables in it, and I would like to conclude just by alluding to those. I'm not going to read them. I think we know them. We all know them very well. First one is the parable of the 10 virgins. 5 were wise, 5 were foolish. Second one is the parable of the talents. The 3 men that he gave talents. And the last one is the parable of the sheep and the goats. I'm going to start with the last one because I think it's the easiest one to get a hold of. The final sentence for the sheep and the goats is either you have done it to the least of these, and we know that list, that's a list of very practical things that we can do to love our brother. You either have done it to the least of these, my brethren, or you have not done it. And in simple language, you have either loved them or you have not loved them. So how do the parable of the talents and the parable of the virgins fit into this? And this is a little bit my personal, I don't know if you want to call it a twist on it. It's in the same context, so I think there's definitely something connecting them. But the one is the talents, where God gives talents to these 3 people. And the first 2 went and did something with them, and those talents grew. The last one did not. He buried it. And God told him, "You wicked servant. You will go to where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth." There's a lot of, probably a lot of commentaries about what the talents are, but I'm going to make it this simple for us tonight. One of the talents, or the talent, I think that God gives us is his love. And he intends, he expects us to invest that into other people. And that love will, you know, 5, 10, however many. He doesn't care how many. But if you've taken that talent of love that he's given you and you've invested it in one other person, that's what he's looking for. And that will be blessed. If you've done that, you will enter into the joy of the Lord. That was the joy Jesus had, to invest that love in us. The parable of the virgins is, that one to me is a more of a stretch, and it's just a lot of things you can do with that. But I'm going to take the oil out of this one and use that to emphasize the point that I want to make. The virgins that went in were virgins that had oil in their lamps. And the virgins that did not go in were the ones that didn't. They didn't have enough. And I'm going to call that oil God's love. When that oil, when our lives are full of that oil and we're burning brightly with the light of his love to the people around us, we are his bride and he's going to welcome us in. But if we do not have that love and it's not burning in our life, he doesn't know us, and we will not get in. That's just one version of that parable. But I think it fits kind of the theme that Jesus is talking about here at the end. When we face God, he's going to look at us and say, have you done love to the least of these, my brethren? And if you have, you're his. He recognizes that. He identifies with that because that's who he is. And if you haven't, he doesn't know you. And you don't know him. So when you get up tomorrow morning and get out of bed, I hope the Spirit brings to you the purpose for your day. Love one another. And I am positive he will give you more opportunities than you will catch to do that. But if you catch a few of them, I believe he will be happy. I believe he will be pleased and say, enter into the joy of my Lord. Any comments before we close?